Hello everyone and welcome to Shedcast Series 36, The British Constitution and Law, 36A, The Early Middle Ages. Okie dokie then everyone, this Shedcast owes its existence to a listener called Andrew, and if you want to track him down, his personal and private address can be provided. And appropriately, it is selected through the operation of direct democracy, not a concept in which I have much faith, incidentally, through a survey and a vote on Facebook. In that survey, the idea of a history of the British Constitution came third. In fact, the winning option was, in the words of those fine political theorists, status quo, whatever you want. So, really, the Constitution option came second. Huzzah! A referendum, even if only advisory, clearly must be actioned to protect the legitimacy of the relevant corporation. So, decision made, I then had to decide what I was writing about. Should this be some discussion of what a constitution is and how the UK example operates? Or is this simply an opportunity to cherry-pick some key events in history through the lens of constitutional history? Decisions, decisions. And what of law and justice? Should that be included or not? And can we really just look at the British Constitution without considering the rest of the world? Well, you'll all be delighted to learn that I've decided to do pretty much all of it. I'm honestly not sure if I had been wise in this. It might have been better to hive off common law as a separate thing. If it therefore produces confusion, I'm sorry. But if constitutions are at least partly about liberty and the rights of the individual, then I felt I must. Though, since I say that, it might well be that constitutions are not, in fact, exclusively about liberty, a theme to which we will refer back. But let me start by trying a couple of surprisingly cynical quotes on you. Firstly, let's hear from that famous political theorist Charles-Louis de Scondat, Baron de la Brède et de Montesquieu, 1689 to 1755. Montesquieu gave the old P&L look at the use of liberties in a constitution and remarked, "General rule, one can raise higher taxes in proportion to the liberty of the subjects." So, despotic ruler, if you need money for, I don't know, a foreign war, let's say, chuck a bit of liberty around. Max Weber in Germany after the war made a similar point, that different societies had wished for and were compelled to secure the cooperation of the non-aristocratic masses and hence put arms, and along with arms, political power into their hands. So for many, it's not just a noble search for liberty, it's a deal, a bargain, a negotiation between rulers and ruled. However, the rise of constitutionalism has been linked to the rise of the nation-state too, and more specifically, the nationalism, the need to define what a new nation is and what it stands for. All these possible drivers then go into the pot of podcasting. Let us start off then with a few principles of what constitutes a constitution, as it were, and then let me take you by the hand through the process whereby the British arrived at their much vaunted liberty, which I am sad to say is largely a review of English history, given that it's essentially the English constitution that was adopted after the unions of 1542, 1707 and 1801. But it is categorically not a history of the English. The glories of the Scottish Enlightenment provided Britain with some of our most innovative judges and legal experts, with names like William Murray, Lord Mansfield, William Garrow, Thomas Erskine. Plus, of course, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, who have helped us to a veritable waterfall of constitutional change after a long drought. There are figures like the Welsh PM, Lloyd George, and the People's Budget and the crisis with the House of Lords, and that famous Irishman, Edmund Burke. So, it's a team effort. What, then, is a constitution? Given that the UK is one of a vanishingly small number not to have one written constitutional document, along with Israel and New Zealand, does the UK even have one? And I'm not even joking. Because this is an increasingly vital question. Once described as the matchless constitution, the world has changed, and really, Everyone who is anyone now has a written constitution. In fact, as we will discover in a following episode, a written constitution has for quite a while been seen as a requirement for a modern state. Let us go to Turkey, for example, in 1908, and to the pen of one Kang Yui. Kang was a philosopher and a reformer who had arrived from China in Istanbul at the very time when Turkey was getting its constitution from its Ottoman rulers. Turkey had achieved its first constitution in 1876, 30 years ago, but it had been rescinded by the Sultan. The Young Turk movement had forced them to restore it. Kang wrote down the essence of the rebel leader's ultimatum to the Sultan. They all bent down respectfully and told him, "Every country has a constitution. Only Turkey first declared and then abolished it, so the people are not satisfied." Poor old UK then, and now we're looking around ourselves nervously, with quite a few very influential folks at the World Party looking at us and sniggering behind their hands. So why haven't we got one of those then? Why am I feeling as I put my pants on after my trousers this morning? I might note, by way of declaring my prejudices before the episode, that as a proud member of the Electoral Reform Society, I come from the stable that thinks the UK needs a written constitution. But I shall put that prejudice aside, try to be objective, and let's see where we get to. OK, so what is a constitution? Well, a constitution might have a capital C, a capital C meaning that it has a set of rules that makes that constitution, a set of rules that regulate the government of a state, a written document, probably including a Bill of Rights as well. And most of these rules are entrenched in law. But that's not all. A constitution also includes a variety of laws that might be considered constitutional laws, even if they're not attached to that central written document. So that's complicated then. Even though most countries have a written constitution, capital C, there's all this mess around with constitutional laws. That's annoying. And finally, you can't get away with it. No written document can cover everything or predict every circumstance. This isn't Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy we are living in here. The mule exists all over the place. And that, my friends, is a classic sci-fi illusion. And any of you who recognise it off the top of your heads and can explain it ought to get a prize. I said ought, sadly. Anyway, so there are a whole load of political conventions that are included in any constitution, written or not. A clever chap called Griffiths described the British constitution as a political constitution rather than a legal constitution. So that means that it's been arrived at by a political accommodation through the ages, rather than sitting down in a pub with a wet towel over your head and writing down a list of rights. But bad news. In a study in 2013, Dawn Oliver and Carol Fusaro found that every constitution in the world is, to a degree, political. So they include a bunch of political conventions which aren't strictly law or written in the constitution, but which are nevertheless critical rules to govern in the spirit of the state. So, a constitution equals a whole load of constitutional law, which might or might not include one central document with a capital C, and a bunch of political conventions. So, ooh, just like the British Constitution then. But in point of fact, the absence of a constitutional document is important for reasons we'll come to at some point over the next couple of years of this whopper of a podcast series. A couple more things while we're on it. Although I have just described the outward features of a constitution, what I've not done is really explain what a constitution is. I mean, what is it really beneath the skin, in the way that Jaws is not about a shark? What is it really behind the chrome and the go-faster stripes? So in 1830, the German philosopher Hegel was able to write that what is called making a constitution is a thing that has never happened in history. Hegel, just like that famous Irish political thinker Edmund Burke saw the constitution not as a tawdry shopping list to control the business of government, the state, as it were. No, the constitution should be the living, breathing reflection of the entity that lies behind government, the spirit of the nation and its people, an organic living thing, an expression not just of the government, but of a nation's manners, culture and traditions. I should point out that there are, however, over 200 countries with a written constitution, with a capital C. Those without that single document number just three. So, if this were a vote, well, unless you happen to be using a daft and inequitable system like first past the post, the winner would be a gimme. However, you might also reflect that a constitution is only worth the name if it reflects practice and political culture. For example, I give you the Weimar Republic, which had a constitution whose authority too few were prepared to accept. We will, of course, also need to explain the peculiarity of why Britain doesn't have a written constitution. And in answering that, maybe look internationally and consider why constitutions came into place. What were the drivers for them? That will take a while, and like an unwritten constitution, emerge from the spirit of the podcast. But one point I'd like to make is that all this constitution writing is relatively recent on a historical scale. There is a healthy, full and frank exchange of views about who came first. Some people have mentioned San Marino in 1600, others Sweden in the mid-18th century, or even their instrument of government in the 17th century. England, ironically, makes a bid with its instruments of government in the 1650s. And then there's the claim of Corsica in 755, and even the nakaz of Catherine the Great in 1767. There is, of course, another line of thought that says, for sure, the first fully codified constitution belongs to Uncle Sam. The US Constitution indeed inspired many countries, and in particular, it inspired Thetford's favourite son, Tom Paine, on a holiday in the US from sunny Lewes in Sussex at the time, to where he had moved, to define the four things that he believed a constitution must have to be a proper constitution. These were: 1. It must be written down. 2. Constitution precedes government. So the constitution comes from the people. A government cannot write it. 3. It must be comprehensive. I think, incidentally, that India's constitution is reputed to be the largest in existence, but don't quote me on that. And 4. It constitutes fundamental law, higher than any other kind of law, including statute law. That raises another couple of themes for us, which will vex the British constitution. The point that constitution preceded government means that constitutional law is different and superior to normal statute law. It is fundamental law, natural law. So how does that square with the British constitution and its principle of the supremacy of Parliament? To be continued. Apart from the US constitution, there are relatively few constitutions which have been going for more than 50 years. The experience varies wildly. So the French, for example, have been obsessively trying to achieve the perfect constitution and have had multiple shots at it until they seem to have finally rested on one in 1958. And that has also been constantly amended, by the way. Whereas Spain's and the Czech Republic's, although very recent, are written in the spirit that they really should not be changed, and that produces its own problems of flexibility. Okay, that's almost enough preamble. I'm sure other points will emerge from England's story, but one more thing. Without wanting to sound like a parody of Winston Churchill, the story of how the British Constitution emerges is also the story of how our attitudes change towards society, the rights that ought to be accorded our fellow citizens, and how we protect those rights. No one is pretending we've reached the end of that process, by the way, and nor am I a Victorian out to laud the British Constitution as the world's greatest. Au contraire, mon brave, au contraire. As I say, I think the old lady is in urgent need of a bit of a scrub-up. Also, you need to keep me honest if I do get too patriotic and flag-wavy. Not, by the way, that I think there's anything wrong with either of those fine things, as long as they don't stop us seeing things the way they are. But it's always worth remembering that liberty on paper does not reflect always liberty on the ground. I will try to keep giving examples of that as we go through to keep us all honest. But when you go back to the beginning and walk all the way through, you realise how much work, courage, vision, determination and pain to break conventions there have been. And we owe our ancestors our heartfelt thanks. Although I am bound to say that the law of unintended consequences are also strong in this one. Seriously, Simon de Montfort would be spinning in his grave at today's Parliament. Finally, while I continue to rabbit and warble, here's a quote by Michael Foote. Most liberties have been won by people who broke the law. I really don't think that's true. I mean, sometimes it has been. Often it's not. I read an article in the New Statesman this week which contained the offline that change has been achieved by the working class. Well, sometimes it has indeed, and with great risk and bloodshed. Sometimes it has been bona fide, dyed-in-the-wool, high-hat-wearing toffs that have made changes. Don't get me wrong, it's always worth remembering how much higher the risk and cost of protest was for working people without the money and influence of social elites. 200 ordinary people were strung up after the Pilgrimage of Grace, for example, but Lord Dacre and Robert Aske were executed also. Sometimes change was achieved by radicals looking to change the world. Just as often, it was achieved by conservatives trying to re-establish an idealised past. The British Constitution has been the result of all kinds of people from all walks of life. It belongs to all of us. Just to repeat the point I made earlier, don't shout at me for the Anglo-centricity of what follows, since the Constitution is really mainly affected by English history until the Acts of Union. At some stage, I will also probably drop a shoulder, sell you a dummy, do a little shimmy, and go international. But since this is about the British Constitution, it's mainly about Britain. Anyway, where shall we start then? Let us start with kingship and with the Germanic tribes. There is a really deep-rooted set of ideas about the origin of Englishness, and they are impossible to dismiss as moonshine because they will, at various points, have a direct impact on British liberty. Lesson number one I'd like to advance is that myth is absolutely as important to nation-forming as is objective historical truth. We spend an awful lot of time these days searching for an objectively true history, which firstly may be an impossible concept anyway, and I would like to contend that no nation can exist without its myths that build cohesion and pride. Also, I watched a thoroughly compelling documentary on Auntie the other day called Black Power, A British Story of Resistance. You should watch it if you get the chance. It's about the struggle against racism in the 60s and 70s. One of the protesters was wrongly convicted on police evidence. In his struggle to achieve justice, he took the well-trodden British approach of quoting Magna Carta and his right to the judgment of his peers. The myth that Magna Carta was a statement of fundamental liberty rather than a peace treaty has been of enormous value. Obviously, to set against that is the need to understand the less attractive elements of our history so we do not repeat the mistakes of the past. Quite where that leaves us, I don't know. It's above my pay grade and for somebody with a much bigger brain to deal with. There is a very tricky balance to be struck. Anyway, this myth about the Germanic tribes and the Anglo-Saxon period that follows is that there is an elective element to kingship from the very start of our history, that it is effectively the people that used to choose the king, and that the operation of the state has always been dependent on that principle of consent. And the king ruled in line with law, or maybe at this stage, custom is a better word. It's connected then to a myth which will form the backdrop to the English part of the British Civil Wars. It is a myth particularly strong in Victorian days. This was the legend of the Norman yoke, the apparent sweeping away of English liberties by those brutal conquerors. The popularity of the myth owed a lot for its popularity to a Scot, ironically, Walter Scott and all his Ivanhoeing. But for the moment you can park this thought, except to note that in the main these myths were hogwash, but that the hogwash in this case was a sight more important than the objective truth. It is true to say that kingship in Anglo-Saxon England did not follow the model of primogeniture, which we think of as normal now in the monarchy. In Anglo-Saxon England, the race was to the swift and the battle to the strong. Alfred the Great succeeded to the throne, for example, because his people needed an experienced king at a time of crisis and set aside the lad who maybe should have succeeded. But that's not quite the same thing as being elective. The king would be chosen from members of certain families with royal blood, athelings, and was much more likely to be a selection process rather than an election by all members of the tribe. The other big myth was this thing about consent in the form of the Wittenagemot, the Council of Wise Men, supposedly a sort of Anglo-Saxon parliament to whom Anglo-Saxon kings must refer. Well, the Witan was in no way a parliament. If anything, it was a forerunner of the Norman Magnum Concilium, the Great Council, which was the king taking advice from and consulting with his great men. Such advice he would feel perfectly at liberty then to ignore if he chose. Kings in Anglo-Saxon England and the early Middle Ages were in fact restrained by little other than politics. The will of the king was law. The Anglo-Saxons became increasingly enthusiastic about law codes and would issue many, but they came from the king. There was no nonsense about judge-made law or calling parliaments or anything like that. The king's delivery of law was a sacral duty, drawing on biblical examples such as Solomon, but also more recent shining examples of regal authority, namely Charlemagne, the model of kingship in the post-Roman world. These law codes did not attempt, even after the time of Alfred, to create one code for all the English, one code to bind them all and in the mist and light drizzle find them. They drew on previous codes, but there were some innovations. At their heart was the principle of compensation, restorative justice, a wereguild which became increasingly complicated, starting off with the different value of a king, a noble or a churl, and ending up looking more like a modern travel insurance policy. You know, one eye is worth 50 quid, two eyes, 55, that sort of thing. So, the king was supreme, and in theory at least his power was untrammelled, though in effect custom played an important part. Kings did change law in line with changing ideas, but society was deeply conservative and local, and custom often had the power of law. I think I have said before that if you work in business these days and utter the words, "We've always done it this way," the only sound you will hear is the distant flush of a toilet as your career goes down the drain. In days of old, everyone around you would have nodded sagely and with deep approval at your words. The basis of the king's power lay in a similar dimension as would survive much longer in Celtic lordship. He was king not of a territory or a parcel of land. He was lord of a people, king of the English, not of England. Indeed, not all land was held from the king anyway in Anglo-Saxon England. Much was held with inalienable right, folkland, which may have had no written title, but was theirs by ancient right, nothing to do with the king whatsoever. The king's power rested on the moral authority of lordship. To add to this came the help of the church after the 7th and 8th centuries. His power was also validated by God, which is, you know, handy. Over time, the development of the constitution will come to be between two antagonistic forces, between authority, monarchical authority usually, and liberty, meaning the delegated power of the people. A mixed constitution, such as the British, seeks to balance those forces. Monarchical authority was king in medieval England, and yes, a pun was most definitely intended there. Round of applause, if you would. Thank you, thank you. That is not to say that there were no restraints on monarchical power. One restraint was custom, as mentioned. Another was politics. Kings who achieved magisterial levels of failure might lose effective power, but the survival of Ethelred the Unready, by any yardstick, an unsuccessful ruler of industrial proportions, indicated just how deeply rooted was the concept of royal authority. That is not to say, however, that kings did not have formal responsibilities. The first definition we get of these came in 975 at the coronation of King Edgar. Edgar agreed to protect the church, to maintain law and order, and to deliver justice. Those would remain at the heart of coronation oaths, though later kings would also add the requirement to protect the rights of the crown, which is rather like Turkey's voting for veganism. To get the first glimpse of an agreement that the king's power might be trammelled in some way, it is often said that we have to wait for Magna Carta, and I suppose that's probably true in a written-up sense. Nonetheless, in 1014, there is this interesting entry in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Whereupon advised all the councillors of England, clergy and laity, that they should send after King Ethelred, saying that no sovereign was dearer to them than their natural lord, if he would govern them better than he did before. Then sent the king hither his son Edward, with his messengers, who had orders to greet all his people, saying that he would be their faithful lord, would better each of those things that they disliked, and that each of the things should be forgotten which they had either done or said against him, provided they all unanimously, without treachery, turned to him. It's a deal, essentially, the political start to a political constitution, where the king accepts that his possession of the crown depends on his delivery of good governance, a common refrain in the centuries ahead. That is what kings were for. The Anglo-Saxons made other bequests to the constitution, though, maybe slightly tangentially, but relevant, I think. One of these was in the development of how justice and government was delivered. By the time the Normans came around to mess it all up with the chaos of feudalism, England was the most administratively advanced country in Europe. The rather sad evidence of this being the extraordinary efficiency with which they paid off the bully boys with Danegeld. The system of shires was largely established, and each shire divided into hundreds. Public officials administered an administrative and judicial system which involved folk moots, meetings of the local community. Two broad ways to bring cases to law existed. Firstly, accusation, and secondly, through the frank pledge and tithings, groups of 10 people responsible for making sure their members obeyed the law, or if they didn't, were brought to justice. Most cases would be resolved by oath-taking, by which means people of good reputation would probably be found innocent, but those who could not find people to swear for them would be for the highest of jumps. A couple more final points about Anglo-Saxon justice. Firstly, the principle was emerging that several sorts of case were part of a concept called the King's Peace. They were essentially very important ones, like murder and rape. Secondly, although capital punishment was emerging, as opposed to the concept of compensation and broadly restorative justice, the number of crimes attracting capital punishment were rather few. So it is interesting to view the whole Whig idea of constant progression in that light. There was nothing of the viciousness of the 18th century Bloody Code, which in 1723 established over 200 often petty offences for which you could be executed. Seriously, don't pick your nose in the 18th century, it won't end well. Oakley doakley, let us take a large step forward and place on our shoulders collectively, you ready? The Norman yoke. you may groan with its weight. The arrival of the Normans in 1060, I needn't tell you the rest, brought massive changes in some ways, very little in others. Land ownership and lordship was the big one. The Anglo-Saxon nobility was replaced wholesale by a Norman one. But in a way, a much more significant change was that Billy the Conk claimed all the land of England by right of conquest, hence his name. So, it all belonged to him now. Gone was the idea of folkland from ancient right. Scattered holdings of land were distributed to the king's tenants in chief in return for their service. Upon the beauty of Anglo-Saxon administration was imposed the chaos of Norman feudalism. Daft things like franchises in the borderlands, where all the rules were different and the king's writ didn't run, driven by the needs of colonisation and repression, which messed up local custom. Just to live up to my don't be too flag-wavy requirement, the British Empire will of course face similar challenges from the other point of view in the future. Public offices like ealdorman, where social elites were appointed to posts from which they could be removed if they didn't do a good job, were cancelled, sometimes replaced with franchises that became hereditary. It always amazes me that there's still a surviving tradition that the Normans brought efficiency. That's utter tripe. But this thing about land ownership. Now, although the title King of the English limped on for a while, King of England was now more accurate. Lordship was very much bound up with landholding in England. The Normans brought no law with them whatsoever, and so Anglo-Saxon law continued. Indeed, Billy the Conk claimed that he was confirming the laws of Edward the Confessor. Shire and hundred courts therefore survived, as well as a law, though the Normans brought with them trial by battle to add to trial by ordeal and by compurgation or oath-taking, and also the complication of separating temporal and ecclesiastical justice, a mess that, thanks to Becket, would survive into the 19th century. We have to wait another 100 years, really, before we can talk about major changes, and those come in the delivery of justice. And one of the greatest monarchs of them all, Henry II, who, when he wasn't arguing with his wife and sons and locking them up or having irritating archbishops mullered, was busy transforming the judiciary. Essentially, his reign saw the arrival of legal specialists, the start of professionalisation of the law, and also the delegation of the royal authority in the delivery of justice. Partly, this was due to necessity. Henry was whizzing around a massive empire and could not be around enough to pass judgment on every single baby that needed to be cut in half. So, five judges were to sit permanently in Westminster. In addition, he extended the system set up under Henry I of royal justices who travelled around, justices in Eyre, as they were known. By the end of his reign, there were 35 of these judges allocated to specific circuits, the forerunner of circuit judges. Now look, you might think this is detail on the carbuncle of English history, but I tell you, it's anything but. It's far more significant than, I don't know, Walter Raleigh and his blessed cloak and puddle thingy, to pick an example at random. The jobs of these justices and heir were broader than just making judgments. They informed locals when they came to visit about new legislation. They enforced those new statutes. They assessed taxes, monitored and possibly fined or fired corrupt sheriffs. They took oaths of fealty to the crown from the people. They were judicial, administrative, and financial governors almost. Not only did they bring central government to the regions in a standard format, they also brought outsiders to give judgment, unsusceptible to local loyalties and powers. But as we'll cover much later, they provide the basic structure for what became a feedback mechanism. Through these justices and their replacements under Edward I in the 13th century, the assize judges, there is a feedback mechanism established between the regions and the centre. Not just centre to region, but also region to centre. By the 16th century, this will become a vital component in the formation of the English state. During Henry's reign, a famous tract on English law was produced, which carried the name of the Chief Justice Glanville. Henry resisted moving towards the body of law known as Roman law, which was used throughout the rest of Europe, and customary law held sway. Common law is still for the future. There's no distinction made between local customary laws and statute law, for example, at this point. But we can see the direction of travel towards one common law. Because now there is a permanent judiciary capable of bringing customary law together and discussing it and beginning to select the best of those local laws that could become common throughout the country, hence common law. Another role that will be added under Henry's son Richard is a system of coroners, permanent royal officials making sure that deaths were properly investigated. And there's another critical principle central to the growth of royal justice, articulated in Glanville. A poor man is not oppressed by the power of his adversary, nor does favour or partiality drive any man away from the threshold of judgment. Now let's not get carried away. Anti-excess patriotism moment number two. All of this applied to free men and women. Justice for the vast majority of the English who were serfs or bondsmen was delivered by their feudal overlords, who could be sometimes a little biased. In addition, in practice, most of the powerful would absolutely and very frequently influence judgments in practice, for example, by packing a court gallery with their thugs, making threatening noises at the judges should they seem to be making the wrong decision. But here is a principle and an aspiration which was often achieved. Also, it's worth noting that Thomas of Blessed Becket put a substantial spoke in the wheel by stubbornly insisting on the survival of benefit of the clergy. Seriously, I'm not a Becket fan. The best thing Henry VIII did was get his monument carted off to the smelters, in my humble opinion. Don't write to me, this is a free country. Okie dokie. I can see you lot saying to yourself, this is all very well and impressive and all, but none of it is restricting royal power. In fact, it's extending it. The king and his authority is getting more and more in the good citizen's collective face. But in fact, people usually don't resent this kind of royal intrusion. They want impartial, professional justice, and they want more of it. A royal judge was much less likely to be subjected to local intimidation than the hundred court judge, because the royal judge had a big brother, the king. Which leads us neatly to an island in the River Thames near the glorious metropolis of Staines, to Runnymede, around lunchtime, 12:15. Now, I realise that we have done Magna Carta. There is an excellent episode in the excellent History of England, if I say so myself. And if you go to the website, thehistoryofengland.co.uk, and search for Magna Carta, you will see the text of Magna Carta, quite brilliantly annotated. Again, though I say so myself. Modesty is such an overrated personal characteristic, don't you think? So, I'm not going to go into the drama in detail. You know all that, I think. Just to say that Magna Carta was the culmination of 15 years of misrule by King John, of abuse of power, foreign failure, including the loss of Normandy, and poor governance. And so, he was dragged against his will to make a treaty with his barons in an attempt to gruntle them, probably always intending to gruntle them in a temporary way to distract them from the massive great stick he was holding behind his back with the help of the Pope. It is doubtful that his barons were ever fooled. Now then, the continual debate about the Great Charter is this. Is it, as many have claimed, the source of England's liberty? Or was it in fact nothing more than a peace treaty extorted from a king on his uppers? This is a debate that has been joyfully argued back and forth. Medievalists have had the best of it, really. Or at least, they are ahead on points. Numerous articles have been written, often in fairly contemptuous terms, that this is no forward-looking statement of universal liberty, but the protection of the liberties of a small clique. And we should, as in all things, let the scales fall from our eyes. To digress briefly, this in itself is an expression that always gets me thinking. After all, am I a haddock? So, I looked it up, and do you know, it appears we do have shared characteristics with the noble haddock, in that it was once assumed that blindness came about by the development of fish-like scales over the eyes. Well, good golly. The first written usage in English is in the 1382 Wycliffe Bible, would you believe? And it's there, apparently, in the original Greek. Sounds like a fishy tale to me, but I serve it up to you with all my soul, and possibly a slice of lemon. Anyway, my point is that the treaty or freedom thing is a false dichotomy, in my view, so just back off, everyone. It is both. Famous historians like the god of constitutional law, Freddie Maitland, have disagreed about how to interpret clauses with other similarly large-brained historians. Names throughout history have gaily misinterpreted Magna Carta in the cause of advancing liberty. The power of fake history to make us better people. Edward Cook, a fine legal mind and a great contributor to English liberty, while also being a bit of an arse, made it his cornerstone. Magna Carta was an affirmation of fundamental law and liberty of the subject, he said, before ordering a pie and a jug of ale, as you do. Honest John Lilburn, leveller, deeply argumentative man, claimed that the liberty of the English nation was all in Magna Carta. The Americans loved it even more, influencing several royal charters establishing English colonies in America, such as Massachusetts in 1629, Maryland in 1632, Maine in 1639, Connecticut 1662, Rhode Island 1663, the Massachusetts Body of Liberties 1641, the Virginia Bill of Rights 1776, the 5th and 14th Amendments to the US Constitution all quoted its language. So, the myth became the torch, which lit the dark and twisting passage to the light of liberty. Let's hear it for fake history. The right kind of fake history, obviously, without aliens or reptiles. Without going into the regulation of fish weirs on the River Thames, then, let me make a few points about Magna Carta. First of all, several clauses use the phrase all free men. So, yes, I know most people in England are bondsmen, and yeah, most of Magna Carta is about the feudal dues of the aristocracy who have barely a nodding acquaintance with the working classes, but, speaking in capitals here, it uses the language all free men. So, hate it or loathe it, the barons are thinking outside their class, and English society is already marching towards the slow death of serfdom. Anyway, Magna Carta is unique in its time for this in Europe. So, big tip for liberty. Secondly, Magna Carta established that the king is subject to the law. Good golly, Miss Molly. Such a fellow shall have no sovereign, wrote Edward Cook, before going back to the bar to pick up some pork scratchings and force his daughter to marry against her will a man she couldn't stand the sight of. Its very existence was a statement that the English could not be subject to the arbitrary will of authority. Magna Carta, much amended it must be said, will be reissued several times, often at the demands of the barons extracted from a weak king, like Henry III, but also from strong kings in times of trouble, to establish a sense of unity and joint endeavour, like Edward I, a man not given to either shillying or indeed to shallying. Magna Carta became a talisman of liberty. Thirdly, and I promise we won't get to the stage where I say, and ninthly, I'll control myself. In the original version was the idea of 25 barons to regulate the operation of the treaty and make sure the king stuck to it. I can barely breathe at the thought of it. It said what? Now your medievalist will look at you severely over the top of their horn-rimmed varifocals and clink their cup and saucer at you in the most aggressive way and remind you that this clause lasted barely a few months. At which I urge you to lean over, seize a rich tea biscuit forcefully, and make the point that the unthinkable had been well and truly thunk. The genie was out of the bottle, and no amount of royal foot-dragging would force it back in. Then you can take a dainty nibble from the piece of cardboard laughingly described as a biscuit and give it the rest to the dog, who doesn't care as long as it's edible. Fourthly, Magna Carta is the demonstration of a political fact that will run throughout hundreds of years of English history. You see, the trouble is that modern history, by and large, ruins everything. So all that 19th century radicalism has created, in my mind anyway, a link between protest and change. Our model of protests are, say, the Chartists, with their Charter for Change in 1848, or at least I have a link in my mind, though I'm probably less intelligent than you lot and you're thinking idiot as you listen. But for most of English history, protest is not radical at all. It's deeply conservative. It's the upper classes who are the radicals here. They're the ones that have gone against custom and practice. Magna Carta seeks to restore changes made by the king against perceived custom, not to revolutionise. It's also worth noting that Magna Carta is not objecting in any way to royal executive power. They simply want that power to be fairly exercised in line with the customs of the land, good governance. Fifthly, how confident are we now that I'm not going to get to ninthly? Fifthly, 1215 was very significant in another way, as it happens. That year in November, the Pope ran a shindig in Rome called the Fourth Lateran Council. And darn me if Pope Innocent III didn't have it that the church should withdraw from the operation of justice. This effectively put the primary form of proof at the time, trial by ordeal, in a large bath and poured the strongest possible acid into it until all that was left was a sort of trial by ordeal soup. Because if God was no longer involved in justice, ordeal tells you absolutely nothing. That's the principle behind trial by ordeal, that God is making a judgment. Together with the concept in Magna Carta of judgment by peers, it was this that led to the development of our much-loved jury system. The last trial by ordeal came in 1219, which I'm sure is a great pub quiz question. An alternative was needed to ordeal, is the point, and the jury was the answer. So, to tell you how it works, picture the scene. We are, let's say, in York, and the royal justice is on his heir. First of all, a grand jury is called, of varying size, but something up to 24 maybe. There's no property qualification to sit on a grand jury, but these are both male and probably, usually, pretty influential men. There'd have been little soil hanging around under fingernails in the hall. The grand jury were required to give verdictum, or vopir di, a truthful answer as to who'd committed a crime around here. When the cases were agreed on, the grand jury would choose 12 good men and true to decide whether the suspect was guilty as charged. This is a very different jury than we are used to. The jurors were not there to weigh evidence presented to them. They were local people who had knowledge of the event, and from their own knowledge, they would make a decision. Judgment then was no longer, however, made by God. It was made by people. Oakley doakley. So now then, let's have a hack at some fake history and tear the scales from our haddocks so that we can be better people. There is this 19th century bloke called John Bright, a man who even for Victorian standards had magnificent sideburns. And he created a very famous phrase, and like most very famous phrases, it's widely misquoted. England is the mother of parliaments, which has been basely corrupted into the House of Commons being the mother of all parliaments. Well, presumably our John Bright was referring to the adoption of the Westminster system in many countries through the empire. But it's kind of come to suggest that parliament all started here. Well, it didn't really. England is not the first place to have a parliament. So, quiz question. What's the oldest surviving parliament? Well, the Althing in Iceland has claimed to exist since 930. Oh, and the Cortes of León seems to have been an early example of parliamentarism also. The León, of course, was eaten by Castile. OK then, what about in the British Isles? Surely we can nail the English tale to that particular donkey. Well, not if you talk to a Manxman, where the bicameral Tynwald was established in 979. Though Mr. and Mrs. Picky would argue that it was essentially simply a court of law until the 15th century, but who's paying any mind to the Picky family? OK then, what about in Britain? Well, not if you speak to a Scotsman. He'd point you to 1235 and the creation of something called a colloquium, though to be fair to the Pickies, boroughs weren't involved in decision-making until 1296 in Scotland. In England, the tradition even after the Magna Carta was that the king made all the decisions. OK, so three times a year he'd have a formal crown wearing and invite all his tenants in chief along for a magnum concilium, but it met entirely at the king's pleasure. He had no requirement to do a blessed thing they said, not so much as tie his own shoelaces. However, finally the English joined the party of parliamentarianism in the 13th century. I have an observation to make. Why is it the great strides forward are often made by really difficult and conflicting type of people? I'm thinking of History and Technicolor on this. We've covered films on three people who were difficult people with a great impact. And they were rather difficult to like. Thomas More, Beethoven and Terry Hooley, all difficult men. You may be wondering at More, but he did ignore the pleas of his family and he did burn a few heretics. Well, there's another one we're going to talk about now. The father of Parliament, one Simon de Montfort. De Montfort was a difficult man from a difficult family. His father had slaughtered Albigensians in southern France, admittedly with the full encouragement of the Pope. Now, of course, we don't visit the sins of the father on the son here, do we? No, surely not. But Simon Jr. was still a very difficult man. Personally, he was proud and arrogant, expecting instant obedience. As a younger son, he was deeply insecure about his wealth and inheritance, and so was very acquisitive. And at various points in his career, you're left wondering whether his actions were driven by a desire to build his own and his family's power and wealth, rather than by a love of justice. He was a fiercely religious man, but he stepped over the line with pogroms of Jews in Leicester and London. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have a few bona fide heroes who changed the world, whose feet are not made of clay, but, you know, feet instead? And yet Simon de Montfort is an extraordinary figure in our constitutional progress. So, de Montfort was faced by a rather weak and wibbly king. But second observation, the monarchs and their governments against whom we've rebelled aren't really very terrible in English history, are they? I mean, Henry III, Charles I, James II and VII, they hardly top the league of tyrannical killers, do they? Henry III was in many ways a very nice man. He clearly adored his wife, managed to do what Edmund Tudor did not and kept his hands off his young wife until she was old enough, treated his Scottish neighbours with respect and a search for agreement, despite a couple of sticky moments. But he was weak, and he was easily led. The delivery of patronage was the glue that held the medieval kingdom together with its barons. Henry III developed favourites from abroad, which destroyed the political balance. He allowed himself to be persuaded by the Pope to claim the crown of Sicily, absurdly beyond his means. He promised to invade Sicily and took on the papal debt of 130,000 marks. Not for the first, and certainly not for the last time then, rebellion was caused by financial problems of the king. And once again, we can quote Magna Carta, which declared in its original form that no general taxation should be raised without the common consent. There are few bigger clauses for their impact, not even the fish-weir ones. Again and again, royal need for money drove constitutional change. So, let me fast forward then to April 1258, and the scene is Westminster Hall, where Henry III is sitting in glorious state. Well, he might look glorious, but he's in deep doo-doo yet again, demanding money from his barons in council. The doors creak open, and into the hall stalk seven sworn Confederate lords, led by Simon de Montfort. Shock, horror, all of them were in full armour and carried swords. It was time to call a halt. If he wanted money, Henry III would have to reform his ways and submit to a council who would make him do it. The council would also take complete control of the king's government, controlling appointments, inquiring into the king's financial situation, rooting out corruption. Henry hated it, but was helpless. The resulting royal proclamation of 1259 reduced the king to a cipher. It was also strung through time and time again, with specific reference to all free men and their needs. This is not a reform movement by a small clique for the benefit only of a small clique. It was a reform movement by a small clique for the benefit of all. It was genuinely revolutionary. The King of France, when he got to hear of it, declared that he'd rather break clods behind a plough than rule subject to such a charter. Well, it was too good to last, and it didn't. Leading us to agree with Trotsky, and indeed my daughter, that it's permanent revolution we need to avoid the forces of reaction regaining control. Slowly, the reform process ran out of steam. Henry III reasserted himself. But in 1263, de Montfort returned from France and was asked to lead the reformers again. The situation called for a clever, subtle, collaborative and diplomatic person. Simon de Montfort was none of those things, and so it meant war instead. The key battle took place at Lewes in 1264, and de Montfort won. But he had won at a great price. Persuading the king to accept a council to rule him was one thing, forcing him to do it at the point of a sword was quite another. Barons slipped away from their support. The Pope and the King of France threatened to invade to re-establish Henry's right. They could see where this sort of thing would lead. However, de Montfort pressed on. In January 1265, he persuaded the king to call a parliament, which has become known to history as the Model Parliament, capital M, capital P. It is so called because for the very first time, this was not a meeting of the king and his great men. Every town was to be represented, plus two knights were to be elected from each sire to represent their community. England, sadly, was not ready, and de Montfort could not hold together his coalition. Edward, Henry's heir, who had initially been a supporter, was now a fierce opponent of reform and dramatically escaped his capture to raise an army for the king. Edward met the rebels at the Battle of Evesham, which did not go well for de Montfort. Beset on all sides, he saw his own son die in front of him, and he provided script ideas for filmmakers by crying, "Time to die!" Edward's men obliged. In their frenzy, de Montfort's body was mutilated, including the removal of his wedding tackle, and the head was sent to Matilda Mortimer, who, being a marcher lord, may well have complained that she already had a few of those, thank you very much. His hands were chopped off, and the abbot of Evesham refused to bury him in consecrated ground. De Montfort had broken all the rules, and his body was made to suffer for it. So, the counter-revolution had won. The revolution is dead. Long live the counter-revolution and the middle classes. We always win in the end. Trotsky turned in his grave, or he would do in 700 years or more. However, de Montfort had not died in vain. The principle of parliaments and the broad representation from across society was now established practice. By the end of Henry III's reign, it was clear there could be no taxation without consent. The Statutes of Marlborough in 1267 continued to demonstrate the reformers' concern for the wider community of the realm, with common law extended to the servants of the magnates, not just the magnates. Writs to investigate royal abuses could be raised without charge by any free man. The king could be under scrutiny. But other things changed too. It's always struck me that the Norman centuries, though brutal in some ways, were quite gentle in others. Time and again, a magnate or magnates would rebel against the king, there'd be a big bust-up, the king would win, pardon the rebels, and they'd all go back to normal. You might contrast this with the carnage of the Wars of the Roses, where people were getting executed all over the place, willy-nilly. Well, the change can be traced back to here. De Montfort had crossed a line, trying to force the king to sacrifice his royal authority. In 1266, the Dictum of Kenilworth ended the old idea of rebel magnates being simply in a feudal dispute. Now, rebellion against the king would be treason. Edward I, Henry's son, has generally been seen as one of strong royal authority, a good king, capital G, capital K. After all, during his reign, Wales was conquered by the Statute of Wales. There were numerous changes in the law, and Edward was a powerful and skillful ruler who made major changes in the effectiveness of the judicial system. Despite that, his reign saw the incremental recognition that royal rule had limits, and Edward was forced to make concessions. If bad governance can create change, as it had under John and Henry, then the other big driver of change are war and finance. It was this that forced Edward into concessions. He fought wars in Wales, Scotland, Gascony. He spent a fortune building castles. Raising money for these wars would require careful handling of his partners. Which brings us to another point about change and radicalism. There is an old trope, probably Victorian again, that English history is the story of concessions being wrung from the kings by rebellious barons desperate to clip royal wings and reduce royal authority. It wasn't really like that. The aristocracy and the king firmly believed that they were in partnership together, that royal will was central to effective government and the constitution of the kingdom and supreme, and on the king's part, that he could not rule without the support of his nobility. By and large, that meant that the more sensible rulers knew how far to go. Let me give you an example. So, in pursuit of effective government, Edward I was eager to recover any lost royal land to make sure that royal finances did not suffer. He therefore instituted a process called quo warranto, in which royal commissioners toured the country demanding just that. By what warrant did landholders possess their land? Show me legal documentation for that. Well, I don't know what your filing system is like, but in the Middle Ages, they were pretty rubbish. Documents got lost. Many nobles were outraged. So, let me take you to a court of the royal commissioners, sitting there interrogating a queue of miffed nobles when it comes to the turn of one of the mightiest magnates of the land, John de Warenne, Earl of Surrey. Into the hall strides the Earl, straight up the commissioner's table, and down crashes in front of them an ancient, rusty sword. Here, my lord, here is my warrant. My ancestors came with William the Bastard and conquered their lands with the sword, and I shall defend them with the sword against anyone who tries to usurp them. The king did not conquer and subject the land by himself, but our forefathers were partners and co-workers with him. Well, the Earl was right in a way, but of course William the Bastard had declared that he owned all the land himself as well. Either way, John de Warenne got away with it, as did many, especially the Marcher Lords. In fact, a deal was done to agree that anyone who'd owned their land since 1189 could be said to have title. The source of the phrase, as it happens, of time immemorial. It took many more centuries for one of the two Ronnies to come up with the phrase time immemorial, but that's another story. The point of my tale about quo warranto is that even a powerful king like Edward I was limited by the need to retain partnership with his nobles. Edward's reign also saw the arrival of statute law and the use of Parliament to promulgate the statute. If you want a date for the start of statute law, such a central concept now, of course, then you may pop 1275 and the Statute of Westminster into your notebook. Edward I was a great lawmaker, and he did not need Parliament to make them. A king was still the legislator, and he could create law by proclamation. However, it was useful to create and communicate law through Parliament, to help communicate to the community as a whole, to create a sense of consent. Although the king created law, nonetheless, his right dovetailed with the right of his subjects to have access to his person and to bring petitions to the king for justice. And herein lay the process for creating law in Parliament, not just the king's plans and thoughts, but ideas and wishes brought to him by his people by petition. So, when you exercise your clicktivism sitting at your desk and sign the nth million petition online for electoral reform, consider that you are following an ancient and noble tradition, the right to petition your government. Nonetheless, Parliament remained an event, not a process, and would remain so for many centuries. It was called when the king willed it, and not according to set rules of procedure. And yet, bit by bit, things moved on constitutionally. Baby steps. It's an evolutionary process, not revolutionary. Now then, in his book on the British Constitution, Martin Loughlin identifies four stages through which royal power went in its integration to a modern constitution. The first was distinguishing between the private and public aspects of kingship. Then, recognition that kingship was representative of the wider community. Thirdly, the king became part of a system in which governmental authority was not just king or parliament, but the two of them together, the king in parliament. And finally came the acceptance that authority derives from the people, not top down from the king. The first of these steps, distinguishing between the private and public aspects of kingship, is a feature of the reign of Edward I's son, Edward II, who oversaw a reign of utter chaos from 1307 to 1327 and ended up being deposed and murdered by his wife and her lover, Roger Mortimer. There's got to be a film in that somewhere, surely. Obviously, it'd be lovely to go through the lives and loves of the royal ditcher and hedger, but obviously, honestly, you are best to return to the history of England. It's a hoot, though. A king far less competent than even John, and possibly even than Henry VI. Two very important things happened, or may have happened. In 1308, Edward II had quickly turned out to be a bit of a disappointment. Once again, the fair access to the king's ear was the problem, since the king's ear appeared to permanently have Piers Gaveston's cherry lips glued to it. Possibly his tongue as well. Yuck. Sorry, anyway. So, the leading barons took action to remove the lad from the royal lobes and were forced to justify their action against God's anointed. They came up with the wizard Wheeze. They were bound to be loyal to the crown, come what may, they agreed. But they were not necessarily bound to be loyal to Edward Plantagenet the Bloke, come what may, who just happened to be holding the crown at the time. This wizard Wheeze becomes slowly from here a key principle in the operation of the constitution. By Tudor times, Elizabeth, for example, will make a clear differentiation between her person royal and her person biological. There are echoes in that famous line, "The Queen is dead, long live the Queen." The crown continues immortal. The head holding it up for the moment changes regularly. So here then is the appearance of Martin McLaughlin's step on the road to the modern British constitution, separating the private and public aspects of kingship. It won't really get going till later and all public and private finances become separate, but here's a start. The second point about the king as the representative of a wider community also has some echoes in the Review of Parliament that is published around this time. Go and have a look at episode 90 of the History of England. Within the description of how Parliament works is this. It is to be understood that two knights who come to Parliament for the Shire carry more weight than the greatest Earl of England, and in like manner, the proctors of the clergy carry more weight than the bishop himself. Put this together with Simon de Montfort's rhetoric about the complete community of the realm, and you have a growing recognition of the importance of representation. The constitution is no longer simply about a ruling clique. The knights of the shire are more important than an earl because they represent a community. Anti-excess patriotism moment number three. Of course, the Commons in Parliament are not really, in practice, very independently minded. They are still subject to all the influences and social power of their superiors. But they can't be ignored even now. And as we'll find out next time, they can cut up rough on occasion. Poor old Edward II's reign is more ignored than it should be, because there's a further very significant outcome of the reign. Sadly, Edward himself gets no credit for any of it, because it's largely his incompetence that drives it. Okay, so off to Westminster Hall we go again. Piers Gaveston has been totaled many years ago, but what would you know? A couple of other villains had ridden into town as his favourites, the Dispensers. Come on, Teddy baby, we've warned you loads of time now. Give over, you daft pillock. Given this incorrigibility, the Lords decided that Edward would just have to go. So there's a tricky question then, not used to this one. How do you get rid of a king, God's anointed? There was literally no precedent for it, no rules. So, as would happen in the future, necessity was the mother of invention, though Mother Necessity would prove to be a hard parent for Edward II. The Bishop of Winchester put his thinking cap on and drafted an announcement, which the Archbishop of Canterbury read out in Westminster Hall at a parliament. The Articles of Deposition included an end-of-term report on Edward II, which, had I been taking it home, would for sure never have reached my parents. Either that, or I'd have put a large book down the back of my trousers before I did. Edward was charged with being incompetent to govern, unwilling to listen to wise counsel, destroying the church and many noble men, losing Scotland, Ireland and Gascony, which even Lady Bracknell would have thought careless, breaching his coronation oath to do justice to all, stripping his realm, and by his cruelty and wickedness, showing himself incorrigible and without hope of amendment. Oopsie. Then a group went to see Edward and told him the tidings of great joy, which he didn't take well or joyfully. But then a legal fiction was needed, because there was just no accepted process to depose a king. So the fiction was made that Edward II had abdicated in favour of his son, freely and willingly. Nonetheless, the whole occasion is filled with ambiguity. The Parliament of 1327 was in reality probably not a legal parliament. Parliament, after all, had to be summoned by the king. The deposition of a living king was, well, nuclear. Hence, the abdication fiction. The screams that later issued from Edward II's chamber in Berkeley Castle and the sad announcement of his unfortunate demise, so sorry, were a sign that no one wanted said abdication to be examined in the cold light of day. Right you are then, that seems like a suitable place to end the first chapter in our history of the British Constitution and law. Next time, we'll go from late Middle Ages to the end of the Tudor Age.